Today's Teisho will be on case 28 in the Womongka, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 28 is entitled Ryutan Blows Out the Candle. Tokusan asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last Ryutan said, "The night is late, why don't you retire?" Tokusan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Tokusan was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Tokusan went through a deep experience and made vows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," said Tokusan, "I will not doubt the words of an old Osho, an old priest who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick and he won't even turn his head to look at you. Some day or other, he will climb the highest of the peaks and establish our way there." Tokusan brought out his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front of the hall, pointed to them with a torch and said, "Even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, it is like placing a single hair in a vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water dripped on the great ocean." And he burned all his notes. Then, making vows, he took leave of his teacher. Mumon's comment: before Tokusan crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrines of special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Reishu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh the mind. "Your worship," she said, "what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," replied Tokusan. The old woman said, "I hear it said in that sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to have refreshed?" At this question, Tokusan was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teachers around here?" The old woman said, "5 miles from here, you will find Ryutan Osho, priest Ryutan." Coming to Ryutan, Tokusan got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his latter ones. As for Ryutan, he seemed to have lost all sense of shame in his compassion towards his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the dust in the ashes, enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mumon's verse: hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. Well, today is day 4 of our wonderful August 2012 Sesshin. You know, we have been doing Sesshin here for 10 years now. Seems longer, but I can believe it. We've been doing Sesshin for much longer than that. We've been doing Sesshin, I think, as a group for 17 years, maybe even more. But some people in our group have been practicing for all that time. If you come on Thursday night and you see Yen Cheng, he has been practicing for 17 years. He started as an undergraduate at our Sangha many, many years ago. Basically, this is the 10th year, maybe. And we've had some really incredibly hot sesshins here. I mean, you know, I think about this all the time. You know, should we air conditioning? You know, air conditioning, sometimes it gets so hot, you know, you just want to put the air conditioner on. And we've had sesshins here where it's been 100 every day. And I just sitting on my cushion, I've just been drenched in sweat. And there's a part of me that says, turn on the air conditioner. But then I think, you know, the ancient ones in China didn't have air conditioning, you know. Somehow they were able to focus deeply and practice deeply without it. So I will try to do the same. And it's worked out very well. Those sesshins have been very, very hot, you know, people come into the Dokusan room and they're really focused, you know, they really are alert and alive. So it's quite impressive to see how circumstances like that can produce deep practice. So, however, you know, even though it's true that when it's 100 degrees and you're drenched in sweat, you can have deep practice, I'm still a little happy that it's so nice out. It's cool, it's pleasant, it's beautiful. Yesterday I was looking at the hummingbirds, sipping flowers, nectar out of flowers, just watching the hummingbirds fly. I was looking out over Gary's head and looking at the hummingbirds going by, and it was just so wonderful. So, you know, it's beautiful. We have everything we need to be happy here. We have good food. We have excellent companionship, right? People with good hearts here. Everybody's working on improving, being true to his or her true nature. Everybody has a noble, lofty, noble intention of enlightenment. So, you know, having good company, having a good, auspicious situation, it's just wonderful. We have everything we need to be happy. So, you know, I'm very glad everybody's practicing so beautifully. This morning, once again, beautiful sitting. We had a 45-minute sit at the first. I was really impressed. Everybody just did a magnificent job. So this is a very, very famous story from Zen. This is one of the most famous Zen stories. So maybe in honor of the 10th anniversary of our community practicing here, this is a good teisho to discuss, a good koan to discuss. There was a teacher in China who was a specialist, a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, which we recite every day, every morning. And the Diamond Sutra is quite a magnificent sutra. And it's really majestic. If you read it in English, you will see that it's really the heart of Zen practice. It's really the core of philosophy behind Zen practice. The Diamond Sutra is a magnificent sutra. The Buddha in the sutra, the Buddha assembles all of his followers on a vulture peak, which is where he taught in India. And the followers have come to hear what they call the turning of the wheel, which is the highest Buddhist teaching. And the Buddha basically says, the Buddhist teaching is no teaching. And then he says that even though we have taught that Buddhism exists to liberate all beings, actually there is no such thing as liberation, and there are no beings. And he said, even though Buddhism is described as a path, there's really no path. It's just called a path. It's just called a teaching. And basically, this teaching in the Diamond Sutra was so revolutionary that the Buddha said, look, fundamentally, there is no liberation. Fundamentally, there is no bondage. Fundamentally, there is no person. These are just conventional ideas. They're just ideas. They're not real. In the audience, there were a number of bhikkhus, monks, who, when they heard the Buddha say this, actually had heart attacks. They were so upset because they had given their lives to believing that there was a path, that there were rules, that there was liberation, there was bondage and liberation. And now here's the Buddha sitting on Vulture Peak saying, actually, there is no bondage and there is no liberation. Those are just words. And so some of these arhats, as they're called, actually had heart attacks. But what the Buddha was saying in the Diamond Sutra, really, I mean, they didn't really have heart attacks. That's just a legend. It certainly doesn't say that in the sutra. But what the Buddha is saying in the Diamond Sutra is that ideas are not real. That ideas are not the way. And the Buddha says, actually, there's actually a verse in the Diamond Sutra where the Buddha said, he who seeks me in form, in the realm of form and ideas, his steps are turned in the wrong direction. So basically, the teaching of the Diamond Sutra is the practice of mu, of mushin, blank, empty mind. And what the Buddha does in the Diamond Sutra so brilliantly is that he takes every key concept of Buddhism and he deconstructs it. He dissolves it, showing that it's just an idea. That when you peel away the husk, there's nothing inside. Now, this could be traumatic. Maybe some people really would have a heart attack. Nevertheless, you know, it's actually terrifically liberating. It's really the essence, according to the Diamond Sutra, if you practice this, your mind becomes clear and unobstructed, radiant like a diamond. So this is the practice that is at the, this is the teaching that is at the heart of the Zen practice. And this sutra is very, very beautiful. It's just really wonderful literature. So there was this teacher whose name was Shu, Diamond Shu. He was actually a monk. And he studied the Diamond Sutra very, very diligently. And he knew all the different translations from the original Sanskrit. He understood Pali, ancient Indian language. He knew Buddhist philosophy backwards and forward. He knew the history of Buddhist philosophy. And he was like a foremost Buddhologist of his day. Believe it or not, there actually are people who are Buddhologists. They study Buddhism in academic institutions. And Diamond Shu was called Diamond Shu because he was such a master of the Diamond Sutra. And he would give talks and thousands of people would come. Like he would come to Rutgers University and there'd be a thing in the Targum that would say, Diamond Shu coming to lecture on the Diamond Sutra. And, you know, thousands of people would show up and he would take you through this very learned discourse. And sometimes people would disagree with Diamond Shu and he would crush them with the strength of his logic and his learning. So at any rate, Diamond Shu was a foremost scholar. And even though, you know, this is one of the things about Buddhism, you know, even though the whole Diamond Sutra says, don't cling to ideas, he was clinging to ideas. You know, even though the Diamond Sutra specifically says words are not real, he was living by words and on concepts. So anyway, he believed that the understanding of the sutra intellectually was the key. And he was famous for his good mind. And one day he heard somebody lecturing on talking about Buddhism, a Zen, rather. And he said, "What is this Zen?" And the person said, "Oh, it's a sect that says you don't have to read the sutras." And Diamond's shoe went through the ceiling. "What? You don't have to read the sutras?" He was just absolutely outraged. In fact, you know, Zen actually, you know, in some Zen temples, according to the Vinaya, according to ancient Indian laws governing the Sangha, the monastery or a temple is supposed to read all the major sutras every year. You're supposed to sort of study the sutras every year. And there's usually a collection of sutras in every monastery. And according to the Vinaya, people are supposed to study, read them through. Somebody's supposed to read them through once a year. In Zen temples, they have a ceremony where they bring out all the sutras. And somebody just takes the pages and goes through them with his finger. So it's just, it's like a very speed reading, right? You just go through the sutras. Now, Zen monks study the sutras very carefully, but I think this ceremony is important because it's really saying the truth isn't in the sutras. The truth is in the practice on the cushion. And the truth is beyond words, for in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. So we need words. We need words in the same way we need a sesshin structure. Why do we get up at 4:30? Why not 3:30? Actually, it could be 3:30. If you're ready, I'm ready. Okay. Could be, but I would not be ready for 5:30, I have to say. Basically, it's arbitrary, right? When we get up, it's arbitrary. But we need to get up at some point, right? And if we could go to bed at 9:30, I would be against it, but we could do it. It's arbitrary. The idea is that if we sit a lot during the day, our minds will become clear and unobstructed, and our hearts will be open. If we sit less, that's less likely to happen. You know, we could eat two meals a day instead of three. That would be okay. But people would begin to get very hungry and weak, actually. Have you ever wondered why we don't recite the sutras in the evening? It's because this is Zen, and we eat three meals a day even though you're not supposed to, actually. In the Vinaya, it says that people should only eat two meals a day. Monks should eat actually one meal a day. But in Zen, we eat three meals a day. We have a early morning meal. Then we have a meal at lunch. And by the way, monks are not supposed to eat in ancient Buddhism. Monks were not supposed to eat at all after noon. So afternoon, that's it until the next morning. We recite sutras for the breakfast. We recite sutras for the lunch. And we recite no sutras at dinner because dinner is off the books. It's an unofficial dinner. And the bodhisattvas don't know about it. But we have it anyway. This is the spirit of, we practice really hard, really hard. I don't know this, but I would guess that, this kind of practice is quite unique. And I think having three meals a day is fair play, because you need your energy to be up all those extra hours at night. Basically, when I come home from Sesshin, I've usually lost weight. And that's amazing. I'm just sitting on my ass. How's that possible? But I think we're burning up a lot of calories in deep concentration. We're expending a lot of energy. So anyway, we break the rules a little bit because it's for a good cause, which is awakening. Okay? And my feeling is that's in the spirit of the Buddhist teaching. Diamond Shoe was basically kind of a stickler for details, and he really believed in the Diamond Sutra to the letter of the law. And he was outraged when he heard about this Zen sect, which doesn't always read the sutras and has an evening meal and does other stuff like that. And he said, "Let me at him. You know, I'll make mincemeat out of those guys. Wait till I unleash my brilliant mind against these idiots, you know, these heretics." So he sets off with his basket of notes on the Diamond Sutra. And in the old days, that's actually how people used to travel in ancient China and Japan. People would have a big basket, like a backpack, and people would put their stuff in the pack. And you know, most people didn't have horses. Horses were like Rolls Royces, you know. So average person was a foot traveler. He sets off. He'd heard that there was this area where Zen was very big, this region in China. And he's going to get to the temple, and he sees himself going into the temple and confronting the abbot and demolishing the abbot with his knowledge of the Diamond Sutra. And then he's going to declare Zen is a fraud, and the teacher is a fraud, and so on and so on. On his way, he gets tired and he goes to a country inn. He gets close to the area where this heresy is going on. And he gets tired and he goes into an inn, and he meets an old woman. And in Zen teaching, there are a number of these old women who are a very, very wise archetypes, a certain kind of figure from the unconscious. And he meets this old woman who is in charge of the inn. And she says, what would you like, sir? And he says, I would like something to refresh my mind. In Chinese, the word tianxin. I don't speak Chinese. In Japanese, it's tenshin. That means mind refreshment. Tian, refresh. Xin, mind or heart. So in Chinese, as I understand it, in Mandarin, a snack is called tianxin or tianxin. And that means mind refreshment or heart refreshment. So he says, I'd like some heart refreshment. Or actually he says, I'd like some mind refreshment. She said, oh, mind refreshment. She said, you know, in the Diamond Sutra, it said, there, you can't hold on to the past mind, you can't hold on to the present mind, and you can't hold on to the future mind. So what mind would you like to refresh? Now look, you know, imagine if you went into you're a distinguished Buddhist scholar, and you go into a Dunkin' Donuts for a cup of coffee, yeah? And you're just minding your own business, right? And this waitress turns on you and ask you a question that absolutely destroys your life, right? Huh? Okay. And he's stunned. First of all, he's stunned. It's like, how did she know I'm dying? You know, how does she know about the Diamond Sutra? But he's also stunned because the question, he's been studying the sutras for 50 years, and he still doesn't know anything about awakened mind. So he's stunned, and now many people would just say, "Oh, an ignorant person! You know, she's just a waitress. What does she know, right?" But actually, Diamond Shu has a good heart. He has a good heart, and he's open enough to be injured by her question. which cuts right to his heart, right? It's like, my God, I can't answer that question. It's right there in the Diamond Sutra, and I can't answer it. So, you know, most people would just say, oh, she's an ignorant idiot. You know, she's just some waitress. I have a PhD in Buddhology. You know? But instead, you know, he's very cut to the quick. And so he says to her something that shows great humility. Great humility. He says, is there anybody who could help me to answer this question? Are there any good teachers around here? And she says, yes, there is a good teacher. His name is Ryotan. And then the Diamond Shoe says, well, where is Ryotan? And she says, just up the mountain. Go up there. And so Diamond Shoe goes up to the temple, and he becomes a monk at the temple, and he's given a new name, which is Tokusan. So he now becomes Tokusan. And he's training with Ryotan, the great master, the Zen teacher. And basically, we hear that this is like a Dokusan exchange. So, you know, basically, Ryotan is holding Dokusan, and then Diamond Shoe comes in, and apparently these conversations go on. And on and on, because Diamond Shoe is an idea man. He lives for ideas. He uses his discriminating intellect. So they have long, you know, Tokusan is trying to get him to experience a different mind. Not the discriminating intellect that forms concepts, but this other mind, the Mushin mind. There's a way of knowing which is not conceptual. It's through the blank mind. It's like intuiting. It's like intuiting. And this other way of knowing is with ideas and words. But we know the way is beyond words, see. So poor old Ryotan has to put up with this guy coming in every day and just piling it on, right? You know, theories and elaborate explanations and quotation and blah, 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 right? And old Ryotan just listens and listens and listens, and then the guy goes. And this happens day after day after day. So finally, one night, Diamond Shoe comes in and he rambles on and on. He's got some theory. And finally, Diamond Shoe's ready to leave, and he looks and he turns and he goes, oh my God, it's dark out there. I've been talking for 4 hours or something. So old Ryotan says, oh, well, let me get you a candle. Now, people were so poor in those days that they didn't have wax candles. That's really poor, but, you know, Zen temples usually were pretty poor. So, basically, they didn't have the pie every day for breakfast. They didn't have, you know, mounds of food. Very poor. My teacher, during World War II, my teacher was living in a temple, and basically all they had to eat mostly was field greens, whatever they could grow, and white rice and noodles. And that was it. And people had a really terrible diet, and there was just nothing else to be had. There was no other food. So, he has a paper candle, and he says, look, it's dark outside. Let's light it. Here, I'll light a candle for you. So he lights a paper candle and he hands it to Diamond Shoe. And Diamond Shoe takes it, but then as he's about to go out the door, old Ryotan leans over and blows out the candle. And then the whole room is plunged into darkness. And at that moment, Diamond Shoe notices that his mind is blank and dark, And he notices it in a way that really reaches into his being. You know, sometimes people just aren't ready for certain kinds of insights. They're just not ready. You know, so, you know, people can come to Sesshin and they can maybe enter blank mind a little bit. And it just is just like this blankness, and it doesn't really have much meaning to them. But sometimes people can have an experience of that blankness which is very deep, you know, very deep. And that usually takes even years of practicing with Mu. And that's a good thing. You know, when people have a deep encounter with Mu, it's life transforming. You know, you could be, oh yeah, I'm back at the old Mu again. You know, back at that blindness. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, as usual, I'm facing Mu. But actually, in this case, Diamond Shoe, it just blew his socks off, right? It was just absolutely life-changing. It's what we call a Kensho experience, an awakening experience. And, you know, I've seen people have, I've had a number of those experiences myself. And I've seen people have them. I remember standing in, we used to have a Dokusan in the kitchen. And we didn't use our temple in the winter because it was just too cold. There was like 6 feet of snow. But in the fall, we would use our temple. And I remember just sitting in the Dokusan line. We'd be sitting, our Dokusan line was outside. And my friend Genjo Marinello was in front of me, and I could see the snow building up on the on his robes. And then he went into the Dokusan room. There was another person ahead of me who was not a monk, but he was a Japanese guy, and I could see it was like the hair on his head was standing up. And I don't think it was because he was cold. I think he was about to have a big Kensho experience. It was like he was really in this state of maximum arousal, you know? So anyway, Tokusan's ready. Sometimes there's this whole issue of ripeness, readiness. You know, you face Mu 50 times, 100 times, 500 times. You know, you could be looking at your fingernails. But in this case, all the vectors line up properly, and it's just like an arrow to his heart. And it's like in Zen we say the bottom dropped out of the bucket. It's not an intellectual idea experience. You know, he already understood the concept of Mu many times. He could recite it backwards and forward. But the deeply resonant internal experience was what mattered. And basically he had it on that occasion. And it transformed him completely. So, you know, the next day, Tokusan goes up on the rostrum. You know, in a Zen temple, there's a separate room for Teisho. There's a room for sitting, the Zen hall. There's another room for teaching. And people get up and leave the Zendo and go into the other room where there's a Teisho given. And there's a big drum before the Teisho. There's a giant drum and a daiko, big drum. And basically, as you're coming into the teisho room, there's a monk beating this giant drum. And it's quite dramatic. Boom, 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 boom. So anyway, everybody comes into the lecture hall, the teisho hall, and there's a old Ryotan sitting on the rostrum. And he says something. He says, you know, there's somebody down there, sitting down there, who was really had a deep experience of Mu. And and he's like a vampire. he has fangs, he's no longer a human being. He's some other kind of creature, basically. Not really a vampire, but he's become another kind of being altogether. You know, if you hit him, he won't even turn his head because he's so deeply absorbed in Mu. Humans are like using half their brains most of the time. They say 10%, but I guess they're using 10% of one half. Because there's this other mind which is accessible through Mu Xin, which is the other consciousness. It's like I said the other day that consciousness is the tip of the iceberg, and under the tip there's this giant iceberg. So the conscious mind that uses words and ideas is like this tiny little mind. And underneath the surface, there's this giant unconscious mind, this giant iceberg. And most people just live on the surface with words and ideas. But under the surface is this giant iceberg. And when you encounter the iceberg, when you get access to the iceberg, you're no longer like a typical human being. You now live in two dimensions at once, right? After you answer the Mu call, you might not feel any different. But if you have a real experience of Mu, a real one, you're never the same, right? I'm not talking about just looking at the blankness. I'm talking about becoming one with the blankness. Becoming one with the blankness. You know, understanding intellectually is not the same thing as becoming one with. My wife is a big bird fan, birder. And she has all these wonderful tapes on bird sounds. So she actually studies bird sounds. You know, and we'll be walking through a field and we'll hear something, she'll go, Northern Warbler. Goldfinch, you know, and she can tell you all the different, and I've actually gotten into this myself. I'm not very good at it, but she can really line up. She can tell you what kind of bird made what kind of sound. That's one kind of understanding, but this morning we were sitting here, and there was beautiful bird sounds. And when your mind is blank, and you become one with what you're hearing, that's a totally different kind of experience than an intellectual understanding. Basically, being able to tell it's a northern warbler is not the same thing as fusing yourself with the sound of the bird, becoming one with. This is very important. You know, sometimes on day three, you're walking outside and suddenly you look at the trees and you just become one with the trees. You're not trying. It just happens. Now, you know, if you go outside after hearing the Taishan, you try to become one with the trees, that's very artificial. That's an intellectual construct. But sometimes if you just clear the mind all day, as we do in Zazen, you naturally encounter things in their pure presence. And in that state, you become one with. Genki Roshi, my teacher, used to say, we can't understand anything. We can never understand anything. All we can do is become one with it. And he was right, I think. So, in this case, Diamond Shu had studied the Diamond Sutra a million times with his intellect, his discriminating intellect. But he didn't really have a deep experience of emptiness until the candle was blown out. And then it would be, what happened was beyond words, really. You know, he could say, I had a deep experience of emptiness, but that's not the experience. So everything in Zen is based upon, you know, if I give you a koan like if I give you a koan like think of a koan. Okay. There's a koan called No Wheels. It's about a cart or a chariot. And the wheels, and it was made by a great ancestral inventor named Keichu. So this is like an ancient chariot, the first chariot that was ever invented by this great genius of old times named Keichu. He invented the chariot. And what happens when the legs, when the wheels and the axle of the chariot are taken away? That's the koan. You might think, what? You know, the koan could be interpreted with your discriminating intellect. You could say, well, you know, basically the chariot represents this, and the wheels represent this, and when you take away the wheels, you're affirming the reality of continuity in discontinuity or something like that. See, but that's the simplest, that's the most basic answer to a book. I mean, basically, that's a beginner's mistake in Zen. That's trying to understand the koan with your discriminating intellect. That's the most elementary Zen mistake. People only make that mistake about 50,000 times, and then eventually they realize, wait a minute, this koan is trying to sucker me into making an intellectual interpretation. But the proper way to deal with the koan is not to try to figure out what the cart represents, but to become the cart. See, become the cart. Just as you would become the bird. So every koan is asking you to become something, right? Becoming. Fuse yourself with the cart. Fuse yourself with the gate. Fuse yourself with the bottle. Actually, if you read books on Zen, they always say incorrectly that Zen means meditation. So they'll say, Zen is from the Sanskrit dhyana, and dhyana means meditation. Well, that can't be right. Because all of these different Buddhist schools practice meditation. So Zen wasn't known as the meditation school. They were all meditation schools. Dhyana means fusion. Fusion. To become one with. So this is the become one with school, right? So our method is to enter emptiness and then to become one with the object of our attention. And this is our method. So in the case of Tokusan, he completely missed the boat because he was trying to understand the Diamond Sutra intellectually, even though the Buddha was saying it over and over and over again, don't try to understand things intellectually. He was still doing it. It's a human problem. He was still trying to figure it out, and only when Riatan cut away his discriminating mind with a decisive, skillful gesture, blowing out the candle, did Riatan come face to face with Mu in a way that was deeply resonant and transformative. So the other day I don't think whatever you say to me. In Dokusan is private, but one person said, I have no idea what I'm doing with this koan. And I just thought to myself, yes, great. See, that's perfect, perfect. You know, it takes years, first of all, to have that kind of insight. But also, just being willing to, when you don't know, now something can happen. Now something can change. Ideas are stale and dead. Ideas are like money. If you take dollar bills out of your wallet, every dollar bill is the same, But they're all crinkled up. Some of them are really worn out. Some of them are new, But they're really not yours. You didn't invent them. You just got them from the bank or from the cash machine. And, you know, if you give somebody a dollar, they don't go, oh, that's very original, you know. They say, oh, a dollar, right? If you made up your own money and you tried to give it to somebody, they wouldn't accept it, right? Because it's too original. The whole point of money is that it's totally not yours, and it just circulates, and you use it because it has actually no dimension of depth, you know. And ideas are actually just like that. So if you read Sartre and you read famous philosopher Sartre, and by the way, I love Sartre. I've read most of what Sartre's written. I don't have anything against reading books, but you just have to put them in their place. Sartre has a concept called be it for itself and in itself. He said some things are, you know, the existence is for itself, but also in itself. You think, what the hell? And you can spend a week trying to figure that one out. And then if you go around to people and say, oh yes, you know, that's for itself, not in itself. You think, I'll be. You know, that darn, I didn't know that. And they say, you are one smart cookie, right? You know? But see, that's not you. You didn't do that. Right? You're not a smart cookie. Sartre's a smart cookie. That's just stuff you heard from, you know, Sartre. It's not really yours. It's just like money. You picked it up at the bank and you're circulating it in order to buy things. I guess respect in this case. But when it's really yours, it comes from that deep place inside yourself. You know, and that's what Zen is all about. I used to go into my teacher and give him these intellectual answers, and he would say, that's not Zen. And it really riled me up. It really made me mad. Because I had such a problem with humility. Ultimately, I realized this is too shallow. And this is the answer we should all quit right now. You know, if I say, well, you know, the cart without the wheels represents stasis, whereas with the wheels, it's active and passive, yin and yang, you know. We should all just go home. That would be a total waste of time. You could do that sitting on a couch. You know, you could do that sitting on a couch. Why are we doing all this zazen? You know, zazen is like a total body experience. We're activating the nervous system in a special way. We're quieting the discriminating intellect in order to turn the body-mind into a kind of specialized receptacle for information, and information is pouring into us from all over. And usually, our discriminating intellect is blocking information. It's preventing things from being received, messages from being received from the inside and the outside. So we're creating a very sensitive instrument through zazen. And if you believe in zazen, then it's much more sensitive than reading a book at the library, which really doesn't require much of you except patience, you know, and literacy. This is a lot harder than that, but I think a lot more rewarding. I won't read the whole story. And it'll take another 10 minutes. Tokusan asked Ryotan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryotan said, "The night is late, why don't you retire?" Tokusan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryotan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryotan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Tokusan was about to take it when Ryotan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Tokusan had Kensho and made vows. Mumon's verse, hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. Whenever Mumon says something like that, whenever Mumon insults somebody, he's really paying him a big compliment Just remember that. So when he said he lost, he means he won. When he said he was a bum, he means he's great, you know. So anyway, that's just Momon's style. So please keep up the good work. Everybody's sitting very deeply. And let's dwell in Mushin.